Thank you, Bill. So I'm going to disappoint a little bit. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about charter schools. We're actually going to go into what we're going to call private school choice options. But we will do a little bit on charter schools as well. Now, what do I do? Push the... Is this a button that I push, or how do I get the slides to work? I'm going to call up my colleague to come up here and push the button for me. Got to always be prepared. We also have these slides in handout form, too. So, as Bill said, I've been involved in school choice issues since 2001, and I spent 12 years in Ohio. And Ohio is one of the states that really pushed the issues of school choice. Ohio, Indiana, Florida, those are some states that have been out front. And I'll say more about that. But right now we're going to talk about Idaho. And I think it's important to put into the context the what does the state constitution say about public education? And this is important, and I think it'll come through to you guys as to why as we get deeper into this. But this is Section 1, Article 9, and it talks about a uniform, thorough system of public, free, common schools. I think that's just important as we get into this conversation to kind of remind yourself, what does that mean and how do we think about that? So go to the next slide, please. So I think what's going on in the United States, what's going on in Idaho, there are conversations, and I've really spent a lot of time trying to understand what are the essential questions that are being asked. And really, I came up with three, and there's probably more, but do taxpayer dollars belong to public schools and public school districts? Or do the dollars belong to the children and their families to make choices about their education? I mean, this is one of the big debate questions going on right now. Should a school, a child attend, be based on their address, their zip code, the neighborhood? Or should parents be able to send their children to the schools they think best meet their child or their children's needs? Public dollars should never go to private or religious schools, or public dollars should go to any public or private school parents choose to send their children. These are the questions that really kind of go through all the conversations around school choice. And I would say education. This is like the big ideas in public education right now. Next slide, please. So, snapshot, just real quick on charter schools. And charter schools are public schools, and that they receive public dollars. They're held publicly accountable. They take the state tests, the state standards. They have flexibility when it comes to things like governance, when it comes to things like curriculum, programs, use of staff, these kinds of things. But they are public schools, publicly funded, held publicly accountable. And in the United States, almost every state now has a charter law. There's a handful that don't. All of them are rural states, like Montana. There are almost 3 million students now attending charter schools across the United States. There are a million more on wait lists. And the charter school program in the United States is growing fast. This is one of the reforms of the last 20 years that probably has had the most impact on what's been going on in education in America. Next. Now there's this, I'm going to try to create a difference here, this what I call private school choice. And so these are programs where taxpayer dollars, or you can have tax credits, that go and become available then for parents to make decisions about where to send their children. And they can send their kids to private schools, religious schools. They can package programs in different ways through the use of technology, tutors, those sorts of things. This is now far more controversial than charter schools. Charter schools have been controversial. We're starting to get into a realm that is very controversial. We'll say more about that. And this goes further. Some people say public dollars following children to the private school of their choice. Now, for higher ed, we don't have a big debate around that. Pell Grant and these things can go to the University of Notre Dame, go to NMU, but when it comes to K-12, it's a big line of argument. So that said, there's a lot going on in America. There are 26 voucher programs in 14 states. You see, Ohio is one of them. There are over 170,000 students who benefit from vouchers right now in the United States. Education savings accounts, and if you have questions about these definitions, we can say more later. But that's probably the thing that's the furthest out in terms of this effort to create more choices for families. There are about 7,000 ESA recipients. That's going to change because of Arizona. I'll say more about that in a little bit. Tax credit scholarships. There are 17 states with that, and then there are 9 states with individual tax credit deductions. So, Just a real quick note on the tax credit scholarships. Those are dollars that corporations and individuals can put into a fund. That fund then allocates resources to families and children based on needs. Sometimes it's poverty, sometimes it's special needs. We'll say a little bit more about that too. But tax credits and deductions, that's if you're a parent and you have a child going to a private school, you get a deduction to help meet the cost of that. So let's go to the next one. So in Idaho, we have school choice, but it's all under the umbrella of public school choice. And so since the 1990s, the charter law was passed in 1996, you have a variety of options in this state. Open enrollment, and there's a lot of open enrollment, so that means that you can be in one district and you're able to go to a local district nearby and take courses there. Pretty common. Public magnet schools, these are schools that have different themes. They're still under the control of elected school boards. And then public charter schools, I think I said enough about that. Online learning opportunities, we have some folks over here who are involved in that space. And then this new thing called public innovation schools, and that's there's a handful of these district schools that are trying to do things very different, more like what charter schools do. There's a couple in Nampa that we work pretty closely with, Bill mentioned. So we estimate that of the 319,000 or so K-12 students in this state, about 20% are in schools of choice. And homeschooling also should fit in here, too. And that's also a growing number of students and families as well participating in homeschooling. Next. So, private school choice in Idaho. We have Representative Vander Wilde. I've got a number, and Jim Reed and Emily McClure, you guys can jump in at any point here, but this and also Susie Budge has been involved in this going back more than a decade, I think. There's been an effort, recurring effort, I guess going back to like 1994, is that right, the article that you were reading, to create a tax credit program in Idaho. And this idea modified, resurfaced in 2017, and in the form of House Bill 234, and it would have created a tax credit funded education savings account program. So what that means is that corporations and individuals could put a check in a box on the tax form. That money would go to a nonprofit school fund, and then families would be able to apply to that fund to get dollars to attend the school of their choice. The state would deposit 70% of a student's per pupil allowance, so the state would actually get a deal on this. Now, what sort of deal is one of the debate points that you have when you get down this path? And then you could use it for private school tuition, tutoring, home schooling. And we, in this conversation, kept it narrowly focused to low-income and at-risk children. They would be the ones that would be eligible for this, special needs students and students of military or those who were killed in the line of duty. So this was proposed this year, didn't make it out of the House, and we can talk more about that, and there's more people here who can talk about it than I, but just note this is bubbling up out there. All right, next slide, please. So there's a lot going on nationally. There was an election in November, you guys know, and so you have a president and a secretary of education who are very strong supporters of school choice. I actually met Betsy DeVos a couple times in Ohio. She was up in Michigan. And they are trying to encourage school choice. The federal government doesn't have that big a role in education. I think about maybe 11% of funding for schools come through federal programs. And so what they're trying to do is, and in his skinny budget that came out a couple weeks ago, they want to double the amount of money that goes to the charter school program. So the federal government has this grant program that allows states to apply. It's competitive, and if states get the money, they can then allocate startup grants to help start charter schools. Idaho in 2005 received one of these grants. It was about $21 million, and it helped start about 15, 16 charter schools. So the president's budget calls a doubling for that amount. So from about $285 million to about $555 million for the starting of charter schools. That would be charter schools under the public school umbrella, space for innovation, but still under the public umbrella.
But what they're also looking at is portability of federal title dollars. So if you're a family and you have a student enrolled in a public school, and then you decide that child should go to a Catholic school, the federal dollars stay behind in the public school and don't follow the child to the Catholic school in that case. So he's saying that money should be portable. It should be based on the backs of students, not based on the type of school. And then they're also looking at federal scholarship tax credits, so that, again, as a federal taxpayer, you could check a box. This is way out there. I'm not sure how this would work in detail, but these are conversations that are starting to happen. Okay, next. So the president, the feds, they matter to this. I say one thing. Betsy DeVos almost did not become the U.S. Secretary of Education. She was the most controversial nominee that the president put forward, only was able to become Secretary of Education because Vice President Pence came out and voted for her. There were two Republicans that actually voted against her, all because of the kind of issues we're talking about right here. I mean, incredibly controversial. There was $5 million targeted to try to stop her from being the U.S. Secretary of Education. This stuff is playing out now in the courts. This is potentially a really big deal. And on the 19th, the U.S. Supreme Court is supposed, I'll come back to kind of what I mean by supposed, so here this Trinity Lutheran versus Comer case, and this is this Blaine Amendment issue. We're going to say more about that, but just kind of the facts of the case here. So Missouri basically refused to award a playground resurfacing grant to a Lutheran church that applied for the money. And they basically said that we're not going to issue this money because our Blaine Amendment clause demands no money shall ever be taken from the state and granted directly or indirectly to any religious institution. And so the church argues, wait a minute, this is discrimination, and this is a 14th Amendment issue for us. And if you guys want to get deeper into this, I'm going to have to call Emily McClure up to start getting into the details of this. But this is a real separation of church and state, and do public dollars, should they really follow students to private schools or not. This is it could be a seminal case. Go ahead, next. And we're going to come back to this Blaine Amendment issue because it's a big deal in Idaho. But the states, there are 33 Republican governors, 24 of whom enjoy the control of the House and Senate, their parties as well. And so you're seeing a lot of movement in this space. So over a dozen states considered ESA bills just this last legislative session. Now, Arizona has gone further than any state in America. They have basically created a universal school choice program. So this month, the governor there signed legislation that makes all of their 1.1 million students eligible for what is in effect an education savings account, or consider it as a voucher, where they would be able to go to any school that they choose to go to, and the money would follow them to their school of choice. The schools that participate in the program have to test kids and issue that data, so there is public accountability associated with this. But the fact of the matter is that the private schools will be able to operate as they operate. So that is universal school choice. They are the first state to get there. It'll be fascinating to see how it goes. Just note that there's an effort to recall Governor Ducey, and so he's facing a lot of heat for this. All right, next. So it's highly polarizing. Who supports school choice? This is kind of a national snapshot. In Idaho, the Albertson's Family Foundation did survey work, and 73% of the state's parents said they would prefer that their child attend a private or charter school, while only 26% would opt for a traditional district school. Now, that number may be high, but even if it's half, it's still a pretty wide margin. Republican lawmakers, if you look in Idaho, like who's been driving efforts to create more school choice, it has been Republican lawmakers, one of whom's here, then that's true nationally. Fiscal conservatives are also kind of nationally inclined to support these programs. Who opposes? There's a lot of different groups. The teacher unions, for sure. Traditional district supporters who, and some of this is philosophical differences. I mean, who see school choice as privatization of public education and fear loss of resources. Make the argument, can we really afford all these different choices? Civil liberty groups, the blurring of religious and public lines is a big issue there. And then the traditional sort of Democratic groups who basically, for them, it's about school districts and neighborhood schools and always will be. All right, next. So if we want to expand school choice in Idaho, that's a question for all of us, the constitutional challenges of the Blaine Amendment need to be challenged. And if the Supreme Court hears that case and determines that the Missouri Blaine Amendment is unconstitutional, that then opens the door for other states to file lawsuits of their own. That would be a cosmic sort of thing. The Blaine Amendment goes back to the 1870s. And basically, Idaho, in order to become a state, agreed to a Blaine Amendment. At some point, there were 35 states in America that had the Blaine Amendment, which prohibited, as it says here, prohibits any state, county, or local governments from ever making any appropriations to any religious or sectarian church, organization, or society. So it's pretty clear what it's trying to prohibit. In the states that have made movement, so Arizona, I mentioned Ohio, Indiana, you've got these committed and well-endowed advocates, Betsy DeVos in Michigan, they're committed to this. They want to see this happen. My own organization in Ohio, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, and so there's a focus and energy and effort and resources behind this in the states that are making progress in this. School choice. This is one of the big criticisms that you hear about school choice. And this is relevant absolutely to Idaho. And the two who voted against Betsy DeVos was Murkowski in Alaska, and I forget the other, but also from a very rural state. So how does school choice benefit our kids in a rural space? You know, there's nothing there for them, so why do I want to get myself entangled in this if there's nothing that's going to benefit the children that I represent? And we can talk more about that. I know Jim's got ideas on that, but that is, we've seen it play out. We've seen it play out in other states. I mentioned to you the states that don't have charter schools are all rural. The other thing for this to happen, and I guess the final point for you all, is that you need political and business support. And frankly, the states where this happens, it's not a, it's a governor-led thing. The executive almost invariably has to be the point person for this. And truly, it should be almost an electoral issue. And so if you want to see this happen, you really do need to have candidates running for governor who say, I believe in this, I support this, this is where we're going to go, you can vote for me or you don't. But it's that level of political engagement to really see these sorts of things happen. And we haven't had that, as far as I know, in Idaho, and I think that's one of the reasons that maybe we've been spinning our wheels. But I think I've said enough. There's some great people in this audience who should chime in. I mean, Jim and Representative Vanderwaddy, Emily, or anybody else, and questions. And if I can't answer them, I'll direct it to somebody who maybe can. Yes?
Would school choice go along with parents that wanted to homeschool? Federal dollars to homeschool.
You could package it that way.
Repeat the question.
Go ahead and stand up and say it louder if you could.
Would federal dollars follow parents that would want to homeschool their children?
So that would be a decision that would go into the program. So I suspect a federal tax credit. I know a federal tax credit would benefit families of homeschooled kids. You might be able to do something similar at a state level. There are a number of homeschool groups, though, that don't want these dollars at all. They don't want to have any risk of any sort of entanglement. I mentioned to you in Arizona that there is a requirement that if you send your child, you take this and you go to a private school, your child will be tested, and that data, not your child's data, but the aggregate data of all the kids in the program will be, in effect, made public. So there'll be some level of accountability for those schools. There are homeschool families that don't want any kind of entanglement like that at all. So this, I think, would vary, and it'd be interesting to see what the debate would be around that. But that's certainly one of the interest groups that, and stakeholders that would be involved in those conversations. Yes, please.
Just an observation. I have two sons. The first one graduated from BK, went to Tulane, got his JD. He's now a public defender. My other one is 12 and a half years younger. He's a high school graduate and runs my roofing business. I would put the two of them in debate, and I don't see much difference as far as capability as far as handling themselves in public. And so I'm just, I run through this all the time. We homeschooled the younger one for 2 years because he wanted to, he wasn't being tested enough in school. He didn't feel like he was being challenged. So we gave him things to read that were my level, John's level, our level, in 7th and 8th grade. And then by 9th grade, he was ready to go back. Both of them A students in school. I mean, public school works, but school choice is something that needs to be there. And so I applaud what you're doing, because there's a reason why public schools are being challenged. There's some people that just don't want to send their kids to public schools because of what's being taught or what they're not being taught.
I agree with you. You know, and this gets, so, you know, having been in these debates, the here's the argument that you'll hear from the, say, the traditional district folks, and I say this very respectfully, that do you really have enough money to distribute it so widely that every child can have their own school of choice, or do we need to focus the money into the traditional public schools and give, and it goes back to the constitutional, the common school, and make sure that every child has at least the same common sort of educational experience that helps to make us all Americans, right? That's the argument that you'll hear. And to your point, you know, I think what the reaction is, things have changed so much since the common school idea, when that was the common hub of where you would go to get knowledge and you would go to learn, that there's so much, exactly, there's so much information now. You know, one of the deep issues here is the civil society and how do you ensure that there's a common understanding among all Americans of what it means to be an American, and do you risk that if you give everybody the option to choose their own school, or some schools may not want to teach U.S. history, or so there's a lot of issues that pop up in this that you'll get into, but I'm with you. I mean, I think if this, and my kids are a good example of that. My kids have been in a traditional school setting. They've been in a charter school setting. I have 13 years Catholic education. And I've always been fortunate. My parents are fortunate. They could make those choices because my dad had a good job.
Keyword, family.
And family does matter, too. Yes, please.
Now, Idaho's had an interesting history. How many remember the name Shippey?
I do.
Everybody remember that? Maybe Lieutenant Governor John Vanderwilder can explain. I'm just saying. Are you familiar with
that? I'm not. You guys, you tell me.
Well, he got thrown in jail because he wouldn't send his, he wanted to homeschool his kids.
What year was that?
I was in the early 80s.
Early 80s.
I moved here in 80, and I remember him getting thrown in jail because he wouldn't send his kids to public school. He was going to home educate them.
We've come a long ways, baby.
Yeah.
This
still
story.
The same governor. I'll be
feels like it.
Well, the point is, we still are confused at separation of church and mm-hmm. state. You know, a letter that Jefferson wrote. I mean, this is, it's, we cannot have a state religion. That's what we're talking about. Having experience, I sent my kids to Nampa Christian Schools. I had kids there 20 years. I didn't stop paying taxes, mm-hmm. and I was on all the school board committees. You know, how do you reconcile, first of all, understanding that it is the child that is being taught, and as these gentlemen were saying, the education, you know, starts at the family. And if they don't have that, we create, let me ask it in a question, don't we create a problem for Idaho, the society, if we have to take care of people that somehow are not getting educated, either through vocational or whatever? Does that also have to do with vocational?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of Arizona, so let's say go to the ultimate universal school choice, you're, as a parent, able to have your child, the money would follow your child, the taxpayer dollars, in effect, be in, on the back of your child to attend the school of his, her, your collective choice. And the theory here is that the market would create choices that you all would want to send your kids to, otherwise they don't get money. So there are distinct market principles involved in this. And those schools that stop, or those districts that stop receiving children, stop receiving money, and they close and go away. Those that attract a lot of kids and attract money can grow and expand and do more. I mean, that's the theory here. That's what's being tested right now in Arizona, and it's being tested to a certain degree in lots of other states.
Just a follow-up question then. That 319,000 number that you used, has the legislature put together any numbers that say, by your theory of saying, is there not enough money to go around in all of these areas so that they get a good quality education? Has the education committee gone down that road to find out how would that distribution affect the state of Idaho? How does it really affect us?
Well, I think that's a good question. I don't know if Representative Vanderwaarde wants to address that. I mean, it does come down to money at the end of the day,
it goes back to, you know, whenever you take it and you start talking about sending a kid somewhere else, then that school looks at it, I've got one less student, I've lost $5,000, and I've still got all the same expenses. So they, when we have that discussion, they'll take it to, I mean, it's going to cost us because all my overhead is still the same. But yet, when we look at the school budget this last year, we said we had 2,000 more students than what we expected. Well, times $5,000 per student, and so we had to pump another $2.5 million into the school budget just to make up for the more students. Now, we didn't decide whether one of them went to Middleton, one went to CUNA, and one went here, and that didn't affect their total thing. The total budget was set by the number of students, and then gets divided. But yet, when you start going into a program where you start talking about taking one out of CUNA, one out of Boise, one out of Middleton, then everybody says, well, I just lost revenue. I still got the same cost. So that's always the hard argument of balancing. The budget is set by the total number of students that are enrolled in all the public schools. And then it gets divided, because we don't know where they're all going to turn out. I can tell you a whole bunch of them turn out in CUNA because they keep building more houses there. But, I mean, Boise doesn't grow near as much. And so the budget is set by the total number of students that are enrolled in Idaho, and then gets divided. But anytime you try to come with a program like this, then they say, well, you're just going to take one student out. And what I want to emphasize when we talk about this program is not a condemnation of the public schools. We all have kids, or most of us, I assume, did, and sometimes the place they're in doesn't match, doesn't work for them. They can even be at Bishop Kelly. They can be at Napa Christian. They can be at CUNA. Sometimes that environment is not good for that student, and that parent needs to be able to make that choice move that kid to some other place. And I think that's the key, is the parental choice. And sometimes, you know, my second kid wanted to go to CUNA and we wouldn't let him, but because he went to Napa Christian. But even at Napa Christian, there were certain classes that I was glad my kids weren't in. And so it's not the schools, it's the environment sometimes for each individual kid is different. Each kid has different challenges. Each kid has different opportunities. And they need to be in an environment. Sometimes it's a group of friends that they hang around with is not good for them. You're better off if you move them over here with a better group of friends to influence them. And so that's, to me, is what this program was. What we were trying to do is create the opportunity for parents to have a choice that they think best fits their child. And it's not, you know, my kids went to Napa Christian, not because CUNA wasn't any good. It's because that's where I wanted them to be. I did not check out CUNA schools. So as we moved up there, my oldest was in kindergarten.
If I could just add, I mean, one other thing, and I stumbled upon this yesterday. I think I've known it. I'm working on something else. Idaho is adding children and families the fourth fastest of any state in America. We're expecting to add 50,000 students between 2013 and 2025. And only Nevada, Utah, North Dakota, and the District of Columbia are adding students faster. So when I was in Ohio, this was really brutal because you were talking about school choice in places like Dayton that were dying. I mean, it was actually losing kids, and so you're creating choices. So you're hitting the districts from two points: the natural decline of enrollment in the city, as well as in opening a bunch of new choices and kids fleeing to go to the Catholic schools or go to a charter. That created, and where you're seeing some of this, Arizona is another one, a fast-growing state. And we need to get the economics around this better. But it could very well be that the best way to serve a growing population of students is to create more options that, in effect, you can do some creative things with a Bishop Kelly adding a campus in Caldwell. And they may be able to do it at lower cost than the district can do it. And so I totally agree. If there's a way to do this and to have this conversation where you look at the totality of things, I don't think a lot of this... I think Boise school district's always going to be pretty strong. I don't think you're going to see a flood of people. I'm going to have this debate in Ohio, too. There are a lot of families who do like where their kids are going to school. They like their neighborhood school. They don't want any more choices. There are others who want choice. So, I mean, I hope this is helpful to you. I mean, this is a very contentious issue we're talking about here. Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, my parents and a lot of the other parents in that neighborhood of Collister were very involved in PTA. And I remember going to PTA meetings, and the parents and the teachers would get together and they would discuss things, and then they set the agenda for that school year based on the parent input. Well, now I don't see that as much as I did then.
And, you know,
years ago.
Idaho is still a very family-friendly state.
Yeah, that's
right. I mean, as states go, this is one, like 67% of kids are still raised in two-parent families in Idaho. It's Idaho and Utah. Ohio, it's like less than 30% of kids are raised in a two-parent family. It's a huge difference. So, and I think that's a great advantage of Idaho. You still have a lot of families.
One of the biggest costs for most of the school district is busing. How will busing become a part of this issue? If you're taking your kid to a different school, will you be responsible for getting that kid there and back, or are they going to accommodate some kind of a busing schedule for them?
That's a great question. And so that, I can tell you how it is in some other states. In other states, districts are responsible for busing kids to the schools of their choice, irrespective of what school it is. Now, district superintendents, Ohio's an example, that would go nuts. But you're telling me I got to bus a kid to my competition so that I lose money. Yeah, that's what we're telling you. So some states have created a statute that says children go to the school of their choice. The district is responsible for busing them. Other states, Idaho's an example of it, is mute on that. And it would basically be up to the families to deliver the kids. However, the schools, again, if there's a competitive pressure, the schools may decide, you know what, we need to be busing kids in order to get the kids to come here. It may be part of their mission. So here it would be more market kind of driven, although you could have legislation. That's a great question. These are the kinds of questions that pop up and you start getting into. The other one is, how do you hold schools accountable? All right, they're getting this money. Is it enough if the kids just show up and the parents send them there? Or should you also see if the kids are learning anything? That's another big issue around these programs that gets debated ad nauseum. So there's a lot of things like that come up. Yes, please.
Yeah, I had a question about, and you mentioned the economics. So what is the transition period that a new school needs this federal support to the point they become more self-sustaining?
You're talking about charter schools and the charter school program?
Sure.
So those grants are usually 3 to 5 years in length. And so we do that. It's one of our jobs is we work with the Albertsons Family Foundation to help grow new schools. So a Catholic school is a good example. Some of the charters. So they'll seek a grant. Usually it's 3 to 5 years. And what you're doing is you're giving them resources because only when they get to full enrollment can they pay their bills. So you're helping them get to full enrollment. There's and the costs are personnel and facilities. Those are the big costs in school. And so you basically, if you want to get really into the details, my colleague Mark Kerrigan can get you so deep into it that your head will spin. But the what we're doing is we're saying, okay, you're gonna ultimately be a K-8 school, but in year one you want to only serve K-5 so that you can build the culture, and then you're going to grow it out to K-8. And so you subsidize the first 3 years of that school or 4 years of that school so that they're able to provide the services that they need. They're able to pay for their facilities, and they're growing into their home. They're growing into their school. So that's how the federal charter school program works as well. That's the idea behind it. And that they can use money for things like technology, for professional development. The law's changed a little bit now. They can actually buy buses with these federal dollars. They can't buy buildings, but they can rehab a building. So if they have an old building and want to fix it up, they can use those federal dollars for that. So that's how it works. The idea being that in time, and in Idaho, it's pretty interesting to know, like 90% of the charter schools that receive these federal dollars in the mid-2000s are with us today, and some of them are actually the best, not only charter schools, but schools in the state. Now, there were a handful of them that went under, mismanaged the money, made a bad deal on a facility, and are long gone. Yes?
Do you have any advice on how to work with collaboration with a school district? You keep mentioning CUNA.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting a charter school, mm-hmm. CUNA STEM school, and our administrator actually has attended DESA out in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
And so we're using that as a base model of kind of what we're planning on doing out in CUNA. And we have a meeting with our superintendent tomorrow afternoon, and we're looking for collaboration. What we don't want to see is CUNA is still very much caveman. Everybody in CUNA is caveman. This is not a school thing. This is a city thing. And we really want to keep that relationship so our kids don't have to lose CUNA as a caveman just because they went to a different school. We have another school, another charter school out in CUNA, Falcon Ridge, and it is very separated from the city, and we want to build something a lot more collaboration. Do you have advice?
Well, I'd love to talk to you about that. Yeah, I'd love to talk to you about that. I mean, so I think the districts that are doing the best in this space are competing. They're like, fine, you know, we're going to be the district of choice. And national examples are Denver, Colorado, where you got, and they have good relationships with the charter schools. They've got good relationships with innovation schools. They don't have a private scholarship program or a voucher program there, so they haven't had to deal with that one. But in Ohio, they do. And I think what the districts do is they say, you know, we are about the kids. We are about serving kids. We're going to create options that we think work best for our kids. Napa is an example of this. The superintendent there, David Peterson, who just left, I mean, he actually embraced authorizing 3 charter schools and said, listen, rather than fighting them, we're going to embrace them. But I want to have conversations with them to make sure that what they're trying to do is something that I think fits a need. Credit recovery was something that they felt like they were struggling with, and they reached out and said, we want to find a school that really knows how to work with kids who've dropped out or at the risk of dropping out, wanting to come back, or young mothers who are having to navigate things, or somebody who may have to work part-time. And so they reached out and said, that's what we're looking for. Can you help us find something like that? And so we did. So what I would say to districts is, you know, embrace it. Compete, and if there's an area where there's a niche that you just don't feel like you can do it well, accept it. And so that would be what an enlightened district would do. Very few do. They mostly fight and resist, and they use political, and they've been very effective. Let's be honest. I mean, I think the most effective education groups in this state are certainly the ISBA, the IEA. I mean, this thing we're talking about here didn't even get out of the House, and it was small. Yeah.
Boise School does work with homeschoolers, and they cooperate. If you have an area where you need expertise, they will allow your student to come to school for one period and then be homeschooled the rest of the time. We use that, and it was quite effective.
Yeah, and there's more of that stuff on Salmon. There's exactly that. There's actually a charter school that works with the district. They share courses. So the district has everybody agrees, a fantastic English program. So the kids from the charter school walk across the parking lot, go there Some of the kids go from the district to the charter school to take some of the online courses that the charter school has done a really good job with. Some of the homeschoolers, same deal, show up for a couple courses. I mean, I think that's the way you want to think about this. And
the emphasis is on that child. The child is more comfortable at home because of peer pressure at school, then he should be home where he's learning and not at school where he's in battle. Yeah.
Yes, please.
I was told that Idaho has such a large population of homeschool children that they have a homeschool cooperatives where the kids can go to different people's houses. Mm-hmm. They're so big that they actually rent out places where all these homeschool children go, or so the homeschool parents can have a day off or whatever. It just seems like
so that's interesting, and we've seen that. And my colleague Mark is doing something. I've been involved something like that with his kids in Idaho City. We were up in Sandpoint with the superintendent up there, and he's doing some of that. Now that raises the issue of should the taxpayer dollars follow the students to that co-op so that they can get materials and purchase curriculum, whatever the case may be. Now, that's one of the conversations that spins out of this, is that the education is happening, they're paying taxes, they're not getting any support for what they're doing. So that is one of the issues that pops up, and that's one of the potential stakeholders in these sorts of conversations. Jim, you look like you want to say something. Yes, please.
So, I worked in a private school for 30 years, 23 years our own children attended. What's always just kind of mysterious to me is that we're an accredited school. We have to meet the same accreditation through the same organization mm-hmm. that grants it to public schools, and yet we've received no dollars, period. And I guess we've been okay with that because we continue to educate students and they, you know, go on. I see the Blaine Amendment for us is kind of a key problem. It seems to keep coming up in this conversation. I followed school choice for 5-6 years, marched in the rallies and all that. But like 80% of our families receive some kind of financial aid that we have to raise dollars for because they so want to be at our school and yet they can't afford it. So we raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to fund that opportunity. I just think that message, I'm not communicating that message to the right people because we're over 100 years old
mm-hmm.
and we've been doing this and continue to test our students and meet the standards that we need to meet to maintain our accreditation. So it's just, I have a lot of questions for you to answer.
Well, I'll do my best to help you. I mean, I'll just go back to the U.S. Secretary of Education. I mean, she had so many forces arrayed against her. And I know her. She has portrayed as being is not who she is. She has embraced what is a very controversial position, which is that dollars should go with children to whatever school they decide to attend. That in America right now is a very controversial position to take. It is connected to, I tried to lay out, the courts, the federal government, state governments, local governments, school districts. I mean, it affects everybody. It's a big issue.
Well, it seemed like at 1 year, I remember trying for $1,000 tax credit. And I thought, we're not even asking for five. We're asking for $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we were already thinking, boy, that would help some of our families tremendously to have that much. But get that off.
Sorry to interrupt you. There's not, I mean, one thing, and I'm saying this as somebody, I have great respect for what we tried to do with our little group this year, but there's not an organized group trying to get this done in Idaho. It doesn't exist. There's some individuals who believe in it and want to try to do it. He's one of them, but there's not. And I'll tell you, if it does really start to move, there will be serious organized resistance to oppose it. I mean, they didn't have to really even organize this year. And so if this is something that's important to you and others, you need to start speaking up and saying, this is where we think education needs to go. You need to start talking to people. And I'll tell you my experience, it happens when you have somebody run for governor on this platform. Arizona's a perfect example of that. Indiana's another. Ohio's another. You go down the list. Florida, Jeb Bush. I mean, it's like, I'm running for governor. This is part of my platform. I believe in it. You vote for me or you don't. But if you do, and I get elected, I'm going to do this. That's what it takes. It's hard for a legislature to do it because there's so many. And again, I should shut up because I got some heroes a lot more than I do. But
the bill we had proposed, the Attorney General says that was okay with the Blaine Amendment, and it wasn't in conflict with the Blaine Amendment, but we still couldn't get the wherewithal on the Senate side to actually hear the bill.
And the criticism was an honest one. It was that we don't. Help me with this. I mean, it was that we basically, these dollars need to go to our schools. That's what the Constitution says. That's what, I mean, it's good people who would oppose this. I have to tell you that. Yeah. Well, the couple that we talked to. Yes, please.
But we are talking about money. So I'd like to understand how that $6,000 or $5,000 goes with each student today. I remember getting a paperback as a child, and from my children, a certain day in September, we need a head count. Is that where the funds go, and then they stay there all year, regardless of the parents move?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it does stay. Once you've done your count, that's what your budget is built on, and that's how you get your money. Yes. If you remember several years ago, the Boise School District wanted to give free McDonald's hamburgers to everybody who would ride the bus, because that was the day they counted how many people rode the bus and how much money they got on that. But I mean, it does. There's certain days that you count the enrollment, and that's where that gets. And that's where they base their on. And it's per teaching units. And so I think it's 20 students, I think, per teaching unit is how they base that on.
You want me to sit down?
You're fine.
Oh, sorry. We're done, guys. Thank you so much. And I hope this was...